The recent Supreme Court decision that had the net effect of legalizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states was based on nothing more than the personal beliefs of five judges. Chief Justice John Roberts warned Americans not to look for justification for the ruling in the Constitution because, as he said, it cannot be found. Justice Scalia went even further in denouncing the decision by stating that his colleagues have taken to making social policy from the bench instead of interpreting the law. Scalia noted in particular that, quote, the striking unrepresentative character of the body voting on today's social upheaval would be irrelevant if they were functioning as judges, answering the legal question whether the American people had ever ratified a constitutional provision that was understood to prescribe the traditional definition of marriage. But of course, the justices in today's majority are not voting on that basis. They say that they are not. And to allow the policy question of same-sex representation or same-sex marriage to be considered and resolved by a select, patrician, highly unrepresentative panel of nine is to violate a principle even more fundamental than no taxation without representation, which is no social transformation without representation, end quote. Folks, America has changed, and sadly most of the church was not ready and remains unable to adequately address the social upheaval of our times. What does the roadmap forward look like? Why must the church start educating people within its own walls and what a Christian worldview looks like? Stay tuned for my conversation with John Stonestreet next on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said. You talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's called the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
John Stonestreet serves as president of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, a gifted communicator on areas of faith and culture, theology, worldview, education, and apologetics. John is a sought-after speaker, published author, and respected cultural commentator. Since 2012, John and Eric Metaxas have co-hosted Breakpoint, the nationally syndicated radio commentary founded by the late Chuck Colson. He is also the voice of The Point, a daily one-minute radio feature on worldview, apologetics, and cultural issues. Before coming to the Colson Center in 2010, John served various leadership capacities with Summit Ministries and was on the Biblical Studies faculty at Bryan College. John has authored or co-authored three books, Restoring All Things with Warren Smith, Same-Sex Marriage with Sean McDowell, and Making Sense of Your World, a Biblical Worldview with Gary Phillips and William Brown. John holds degrees from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and Bryan College. You can connect with John at breakpoint.org or follow him on Twitter at JBStoneStreet. Welcome to the Soaring Eagles Radio Show, John.
Thank you. It's great to be on with you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor for me to chat with you on these very important topics today. As a pastor and an apologist, I frequently speak with people about worldviews. First, what they are, and then second, about why they're important to understand. But would you tell our listeners, just very briefly, what is a worldview? And then secondly, how does an individual's worldview shape their perspective on all of life?
Well, it's kind of a, you know, kind of inherent in the definition of worldview, that it's that framework of basic beliefs that we have through which we see everything. So our worldview really, it does impact how we see everything, but not only how we see things, also how we behave in terms of kind of setting our value systems and so on. Yeah. Every single person you meet, I mean, to be human is to have kind of a set of assumptions about life and its meaning, about reality and truth and God and what it means to be human. And some of these questions that, you know, philosophers would call the great questions or the moral questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't usually sit around and ask these questions, but it doesn't mean we haven't actually wrestled with them.
That's,
I mean,
true.
Something gets us up in the morning,
mm-hmm.
something we consider worth loving and caring for and working hard for and believing. What that is, you know, it really is, makes up our worldview, and mm-hmm. how we see the world will then determine how we live in it. And that's why really taking time to think through, wait a minute, what do I believe? It's especially true for Christians, because Christians should have a worldview that's shaped by the Bible. It's what
yes.
Paul says, we have the mind of Christ. We should love God with our minds. But many Christians love Jesus on one hand, but then see the world from a secular worldview on the other. And so our goal is to see all of life as God created it, as Christ sees it, and especially when it comes to those issues which really affect people.
Yes. Yeah. And contained within a worldview is our perspectives or beliefs that really have to do with our origin. Where did we come from? It has to do with our destiny. Where are we going? It has to do with our morality. Where does that come from? Is it subjective or objective? And those kinds of things. So worldview does shape who we are and how we see the world. John, is it true that nations and even cultures within nations can also have a worldview? And if so, how is that shaped?
Sure. I mean, every movie, every television show, every law, every public policy reflects worldview assumptions. And, yeah. you know, as people, we don't live isolated from other people. We live
yeah.
together in families and neighborhoods
right.
and communities and eventually countries. And so, yeah, our cultures will reflect. Like, that's what the word culture means. Chuck Colson used to say this, you know, a culture is made up or is driven by a group of people's cult, or what they worship, how they kind
yes.
of a religious belief. And so really how a group of people together see the world will then drive that culture in a, you know, one way or the other. So for example, if you believe all humans are made in the image and likeness of God, if that's, you know, in a, for example, a founding document like the Declaration, we hold these truths to be self-evident
mm-hmm.
that all are created equal. Well, you got to ask, well, where does that thought come from? For a nation,
yeah,
you know, the founders said it was self-evident, but if you actually look around, it's pretty self-evident that we're not equal.
Yeah.
So what they think is self-evident is an internal quality, not an external quality.
That's right.
Well, you know, that would depend on whether you believe there is such a thing as internal and not just external. So that's the way, you know, our framework as a nation can be shaped as well.
Yes. Some statistics, and of course, you need to take some statistics with a grain of salt and understand where they're coming from and who commissioned them and who's actually paying for the survey. But there are some good statistics out there that suggest that the Christian community has not done a very good job of passing our faith down to the next generation. Some recent surveys that I've looked at, John, suggest that nearly 70% of our youth who attend church with their family, once they graduate high school and they're off to college, they drop out. Now, that is alarming to me as a pastor and a father of four grown children now, but I would think that is an alarming statistic for families. What are some of the things that Christians should be paying attention to and things that they can do in the family with their children and even in the church as a whole to address this and maybe reverse this trend?
Yeah, those are interesting statistics. There's been a lot of different studies done on them, and they really differ once you get into subcategories of whether
yes.
they're in a church that took the intellectual life seriously, whether these mm-hmm. students had personal mentors, whether they were close with their families. And so it kind of reveals the sort of things that we should care about in terms of, you know, really trying to keep students connected to the faith. One of the first things is if faith for them is only kind of a personal, private activity that they do on Sundays, and it's not really connected with the rest of life, then when they're in a new environment, maybe on their own in their 20s or maybe at college, where there's no real incentive family-wise or whatever to go to church, then they're going to drop out, not because they necessarily have rejected it, but more or less because it just ceased to be relevant. Yeah. And so churches that really can engage the wholeness of the gospel and how it affects the whole of life are going to be way ahead on that. The second thing is a church that takes these difficult questions that come up when you're in college, questions about life and truth and, you know, science and, you know, these competing beliefs that students often hear when they go off to university. If that's the first thing they've ever heard, some of the challenges to the Christian faith, and they're not in a position, they're not in an environment where they can get answers, well, that's going to have an effect. You know, there's a lot of students that just assume that, you know, Christianity is a fairy tale, mainly because they've never had to wrestle with the intellectual reasons why Christianity is true, why Jesus actually did rise from the dead, why the Bible can be trusted, and the Gospels are legitimate eyewitnesses. And I think the biggest tragedy of that, Mike, is that these resources that demonstrate the truthfulness of Christianity are all over the place.
Yes.
So if students have never seen them, it's really our fault for not exposing them to these resources. I mean, the resources, you know, this is what some people have called the golden age of apologetics.
Yes.
If there's a tough question for Christianity, it's been answered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just a question of being able to reveal that question to them. And then there's no no substitute at all for personal relationships. You know, if kids have strong personal mentoring relationships with adults in their church, they're far, far, far more likely, according to statistics, to stay connected.
Yeah.
That actually might be one of the greatest indicators. If church is not a place where they belong, if it's just a place where they attend, then there's really no reason for them to continue when they have a new place they belong.
Yeah.
And so that's really the intergenerational and mentoring level relationships are key there as well.
Yeah, and I think, John, because of our I'm just speaking with a very broadly here, because of the church's I don't want to say inability, but perhaps lack of effort in training and teaching and educating believers on worldview and all of the subtopics that come under that, apologetics and all of the answers that Christianity has to offer to those who have objections or curiosity or questions about the Christian faith. But because of that lack, I think that results to a certain degree in the culture looking at Christianity and Christians as individuals as being somewhat ignorant or intolerant, maybe behind the times with the cultural trends, and maybe even bigoted, and that's sad. When Christians cannot explain why sexual activity outside of the covenant of marriage is sin, when they can't explain that to their coworkers who are asking genuine questions, I think the culture has a right to look at us kind of cross-eyed, don't you?
Well, absolutely, and part of that is has to, you know, rest on being able to see the ideas that are shaping our culture right now.
Yeah,
we don't live in a culture that shares our same assumptions about human dignity or about sexual,
yes,
identity or about gender diversification or,
yeah,
any of those things.
Right.
So when we go out and say, you know, sex should be between a man and a woman in the context of marriage, I mean, it sounds like Chinese to,
yeah,
you know, to somebody who speaks English.
Right.
I mean, it just sounds like a bizarre sort of thing to say.
Yeah.
And the only reason one could actually, you know, come up with why would anyone say that has to do with hate and intolerance and bigotry. And that, of course, is exactly what's happening on the topic of in particular, all the issues surrounding LGBT issues, as well as you know, any of the other fruits of the sexual revolution, including same-sex marriage or now transgenderism and others.
Mm-hmm.
We're on completely different categories in terms of what we think people are,
yeah,
and so that's going to lead to a lot of these conflicts. And so, the ability for Christians first and foremost to know what they believe, secondly, why they believe it, and third, the ability to articulate it in a way that loves people well is, it's exactly what the Bible commands of every generation ever, of Christians, but it's just, it's acutely important, I think, in our culture.
Yeah, I think so too. This idea of having a right to happiness, it's become almost exclusively linked to the right to pursue sexual impulses without restraint. Is this another example of the redefinition of words to mean whatever the culture needs them to mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, all of these issues have to do with the redefinition of words. One of the most important things to understand about how ideas get into culture is that they get into culture by definitions. And most of the time, these definitions aren't argued or debated. It's not like we stood up and had a rational debate on a definition of marriage or a definition of sexual norms or anything like that. This stuff comes often through the imagination. This is particularly true of this right for happiness. The other thing we need to understand about ideas is not only do they have competing definitions. I mean, what we mean by happy and what someone else means by happy. I mean, if we think about it, if something is designed, then it will function best according to that design. If you assume that the world's not designed, then something's up for redefinition based on whoever is the most persuasive or powerful or compelling. And what we have now is a definition of happiness that's disconnected from anything about human design, particularly in the area of sexuality. And so it's important to know that, ideas have those definitions. But these definitions also come through histories, and you could say that ideas have context, a historical context. So we're living in the wake of the sexual revolution, and so all the issues of happiness and the ability to pursue happiness, when our founders used that language, they were talking about the ability to pursue virtue, because virtuous lives were considered the best lives. Today, we live in this wake of the sexual revolution in which there are a couple ground-level assumptions that have been just kind of thoroughly drilled into almost every cultural sphere. Mm-hmm. One is that sex, marriage, and babies are not inherently connected. They're separable.
Yeah.
You can divorce those three. So we have sex without marriage. We have marriage without babies. We have babies without sex. Mm-hmm. We have sex without babies. All of those things have been divorced. The second thing is that men and women are interchangeable, that there's no distinct differences between males and females. And when you put both of those ideas in place, then happiness becomes the ability almost exclusively to what we could call sexual freedom, although that's a bad definition of freedom. We can come back to that. But also then autonomy, the ability to define oneself. Yeah. If there is no design, then there is no designer. There's no designer. There's no definer. There's no one defining what things mean.
Yes.
And so we become the highest authority on these things. And that's, I think that's probably a good summary of how we got to where we are.
Yes. Yes. And I appreciate your comments, John, about all of these issues have a context. And this idea of a right to happiness certainly has a context, and we can trace that back to the teachings, the writings, and the influence of Sigmund Freud and his psychology. Once embedded into the culture, it advanced, it being Freud's theories about sexuality and the repression of the impulses and so on. And I don't want to do a deep dive into that. But Freud's teachings did take hold in our culture. It grabbed a hold of the avant-garde for sure in the art and entertainment, and it found itself being expressed in the 1950s, and then it was responsible for the sexual revolution of the 1960s, I believe, and a clear presentation of the viewpoint that sexual expression in all forms was healthy and justified, was celebrated. I grew up in the 60s, and so I remember that time. That in turn led to a rise of what was termed and still is free love, which which found expressions in the pornography industry, of which Hugh Hefner is a notable benefactor. This idea, though, of a right to happiness really was the basis for what the Supreme Court argued and then legalized in their decision concerning gay marriage. But that's nothing more than what the worldview of America had become. Am I making a case for that, John?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. I mean, I think Freud wasn't the only source of those ideas. I mean, this was very much connected with kind of the utopian visions of
yes.
the 20th century that we could fix the world, primarily through eugenics, and that had to do with controlling the procreative process, either by sterilization, birth control, access, and so on. And these things are very, very closely connected, and I also think your point on Hugh Hefner is very important. He wasn't just the benefactor of these ideas. I mean, culture tends to shift primarily through art and education.
Yes.
And he was the key artist of the sexual revolution, and there was also the whole educational process as well.
Mm-hmm.
But to go to your point in terms of happiness, this was said. Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority decision here in Obergefell, also had basically found, had put in, the mystery clauses. He had used phrases in former decisions, which basically centered human dignity and human rights around. He wasn't the first, but he certainly is the most prominent in our generation to center happiness and dignity around the autonomy, the right
yes.
to define one's own meaning, as if there were no natural constraints. I mean, this is an amazing time we've reached. I mean,
yes.
One can think, for example, of the Bruce Jenner situation, and
mm-hmm.
where a line was repeated from, with Chaz Bono, the son of Sonny and Cher, who also transitioned, where he said it to a Good Morning America host that his gender was between his ears, not between his legs.
Hmm.
And that's a remarkable statement.
It is.
Certainly there's some gender between our ears, but there's still an awful lot of gender between our legs.
Yes.
And to say that observable biological physical reality can be deconstructed and reconstructed, Christians are often accused of being kind of esoteric and in the clouds and
yeah.
don't have their feet on the ground, and yet we're kind of the folks in culture right now kind of pointing to physical reality and saying that still matters, and so it's an interesting place to get to. And when that stuff gets enshrined into law, that we can actually remake that the world essentially is a place that's not designed, but it's a place that we create and recreate according to our whims, particularly in the area of sexuality, and that's the source of dignity. Then you also get the other part of Kennedy's decision, which was probably the most scandalous in my mind, is that he essentially argued in the Obergefell decision that we are obviously, he said, a more enlightened and tolerant, moral people.
Yeah.
Why? Because we recognize that new definition of happiness. I just found it incredible that, 2 weeks later was when the first video from the Center for Medical Progress exposing
yes.
the Planned Parenthood practices
mm-hmm.
came out. And I thought to myself, is this the enlightened society that Kennedy talked about? And, and the answer is yes, that's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a society that thinks our own autonomy is higher than any natural
yes.
design. It doesn't matter when life begins. If we don't like it, we can snuff it out, and why not profit on it on the side? And people are surprised that this is what happens when people, in the final verse of Judges, in the words of that verse, then there's no king and we do whatever's right in our own eyes. Well, this is what happens. So,
yes.
We've gotten to this place honestly, I guess you could say.
Yes, that's a very good point, John. Very good point. You co-authored a book with Sean McDowell titled Same-Sex Marriage, A Thoughtful Approach to God's Design for Marriage. I'm wondering if you could take some time and walk our listeners through what it was that you and Sean were attempting to do in that book and some of the major points that you were making.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the main thing we Sean's been a friend for a long time. He's the son of the brilliant and great Josh McDowell. Sean's PhD in apologetics and worldview himself, and a terrific writer and speaker. And
yes,
we speak at a lot of different places together, and we just started to address this, and just we both felt like we had to do something. You know, we had to say something, and for different reasons. You know, for Sean, he was actually in the middle of a PhD project on the apostles, and basically trying to understand. It's kind of widely assumed that all of the apostles, other than Judas, all of the apostles, obviously that Judas was not an apostle, but all the 11, you know, died a martyr's death. And you know, this was more legend than, you know, established fact. And so he wanted to go in and see what are we sure of, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just inspired by these stories of sacrifice and martyrdom, and just thought, you know, what if my kids ask me one day, "Hey, Dad, what was the big deal when you were, you know, in your ministry?"
Yes.
And he wanted to be able to say that he was courageous, and I think that's a noble thing.
It is. Yes.
We both felt like that there had been a lot written on a scholarly level on the definition of marriage that was very technical and so on, and that some of that needed to be translated down so that it could be really accessible. So we really wanted to write a book that high school and college students could really, reach. And then also, there was a lot of stuff that had been written. Most of what had been written was talking about same-sex marriage as if it were on the way, as if it were still coming, mm-hmm. as if it might yet not come.
Mm-hmm.
And we were both pretty convinced in our work with students that it was, for all practical purposes, here.
Yeah.
We weren't sure what the Supreme Court would do. It looked like, you know, it was pretty obvious what they were going to do. But essentially, we just felt like it was already here in the cultural imagination. The law is not the final say of what's in the culture. I live in Colorado, you know, 3 years before Obergefell,
mm-hmm.
And 2 years before they started marrying same-sex couples in Colorado. A baker in Denver was sued, penalized, and sent to sensitivity training.
Mm-hmm.
Because he refused to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding,
yeah.
in a state where we did not recognize same-sex weddings. I mean, it was this ironic thing where he's in trouble for doing something that didn't exist
right.
in the state. And so we realized, and especially with the students we talked to, and of course the media was talking about it as if it were inevitable, and it looked like everything had been put into place. We wanted to wrestle with the question, what do we do now? Now that it's here, how do you live in a culture that enshrines and legalizes something that ought not be?
Yeah.
And on one hand, we had, you know, folks, including, you know, I had one pastor look at me and say, "John, it's over, we've lost." You know, as if this was a cause of great, great despair. And listen, it's a cause of great concern,
mm-hmm.
but we have to remember that no matter what happens, no matter what Anthony Kennedy decides to write in a Supreme Court decision, the larger truth of our culture and all cultures and every culture in history is that Christ has risen from the dead,
yes.
and that secures history.
Mm-hmm.
So Christians are called to be people of hope. So at one hand, we thought, well, you know, there's an awful lot of Christians throwing their hands up in despair. On the other hand, there was Christians ready to capitulate. We published a book in early 2014. We did not anticipate the number of Christians, and of course, many who called themselves evangelical, although in most ways they're not, but they called themselves evangelical, saying, you know, that God actually wanted us all along to affirm loving, committed same-sex relationships, as if the entire history of the church had been wrong on that point.
Wow.
So, you know, between those two reactions, complete despair and complete capitulation, we thought there needed to be something to walk us through, not only how should Christians think about this issue, which is the first half of the book, but then what do we do now, which is the second half of the book. And so that's how we walk through it.
Yeah. Well, that's very valuable, especially the, okay, what do we do now portion of the book. What kind of feedback have you received, John, to the book?
Oh, we've made lots of friends, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, no, it's a funny thing. You know, honestly, overall, it's been talked about as fair. I mean, actually, one of the better compliments I'm surprised at, and you can see these on Amazon, is, you know, people saying, oh, this is the latest, you know, anti-gay, but they're nice about it. Yeah. So, like, well, listen, we are nice about it. That's good. Actually, Sean, not too long ago, was asked to go on a a national news network to talk about the Bruce Jenner situation. And when the mm-hmm. producer heard how he was going to talk about it, he said, "Oh, you're too nice. We need somebody who's meaner." Passed him over. So, but you know what? That's okay. We challenge. You know, we found that many schools, you know, youth groups, churches are doing it together as a study. There's certainly lots of individuals. It's sold very well. People seem to be very interested and respond to it. The reviews on Amazon are terrific, and the feedback we've gotten from churches is really strong because it's, again, a rational, thoughtful approach. We take seriously the challenges, the critiques, and then we also give, okay, how do we live? Because, you know, I think most of us find ourselves in a place where we feel like on this issue in particular, we're choosing between truth and love. As if the first commandment and the second like unto it are in competition. That we can't really love God and love our neighbor at the same time on this one. You know, we can't really stand for truth and love at the same time. And so we either have to compromise truth or compromise love. And if we think those two things are in conflict, the problem is with us because they both find their fulfillment in the person of Jesus Christ, who yes. was truth and who, who is truth and who is love. And so that's really what we wanted to do. And the feedback has been pretty positive and encouraging. And people, we've gotten a lot of thank you emails about it.
That's excellent. Yeah, I agree. The one thing that we need to hang on to is hope. I've answered people's questions on this topic this way, and that is that there will be many who will come out of gay marriages disillusioned. They went in with great hope. They finally had the legal standing to marry, and they thought that life was going to be grand and everything was going to be peaches and cream, and we just know that's not reality. And so many people are going to come out of gay marriages very disillusioned, and so the church needs to be prepared with an answer that is hopeful and that points people to Jesus Christ. So I appreciate your answer on that, John. It seems that the last 2 to 3 decades, Christianity has become in the least enamored with and at worst fell for the belief in a political solution to maintaining our national morality. I find it interesting that Republican debates that are going on now, a lot of people are posturing to try and attract the evangelical vote. Would you comment, John, on this belief that Christianity has, to a degree, tried to take the political route to a national morality, and in my opinion, and you can answer it obviously in your opinion, but they've taken this political solution a little bit too far and placed a little bit too much trust and hope in the politicians, and they've not received the results that they were hoping for.
Well, I think it started with some legitimate concern. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, the religious right wanted to take over America. I think, you know, better histories have been told, whereas right. essentially the sexual, particularly the sexual revolution, I mean, abortion on demand, the most liberal, abortion laws, on the planet we saw in the 1973, and then, you know, prayer out of schools and pornography on the front of the shelves and mm-hmm. teen sexual rates and sexually transmitted diseases. And, I think these guys kind of felt like, they were going to lose their capacity to actually preach the gospel. Mm-hmm. And so many of them stepped up and did that. But, you know, that's the thing. I mean, you know, what I think what we many times fail to realize is that most of the time, politics is a reflection on culture, where culture itself is. Mm-hmm. Now, don't get me wrong, and it's not always that way. Sometimes politics is upstream from culture. Sometimes a political decision, you know, teaches a culture and changes it. We saw that with the civil rights movement, civil rights legislation, where you had plenty of parts of the country that weren't ready for it, and yet it led it, and so on. But I think, if you try to win all battles politically, you can get the right people elected, and at the same time, you can be surprised when art and education and all these other cultural spheres shift. You know, it's interesting on the same-sex marriage issue. Almost every other, if you kind of divide culture up into different spheres, like education and art and commerce and, you know, law and science and so on, almost every other one of these spheres of culture shifted before politics did on the issue of same-sex marriage. Yeah. Even business, you know, it was, and not by much, but, you know, businesses were ready with a commercial, you know, celebrating gay parenting, and, you know, many corporations came out against the RFRA law in Indiana, which was a huge, you know, incident with the amount of pressure that was on the Indiana business community that had put on the government. I mean, that was a really remarkable development. So yeah. you see that, and I think that's really what the limitations are. On the flip side, too, we realize that, you know, the church has found itself throughout history and times of cultural pressure and, you know, what you might say, you know, kind of, you know, on the wrong side of history, you know, yeah. where a sexually broken society that would seem to have been, you know, intent on stamping Christian morality and maybe Christianity itself out. And but see, what we need to realize is those bad ideas also have lifespans. It's not just that, you know, good ideas have consequences, bad ideas do as well. And, you know, throughout history, it's demonstrable that a society can't be built on the lies of so-called sexual freedom. And so we have, you know, that's kind of what we've gotten, you know, in store for us, is we're going to see those lies kind of play themselves out. Yeah. The other thing, though, that I think the temptation when we're in a time like this is then to see cultural success only in terms of political success.
Yes.
And losses in terms of political losses. This is what Chuck Colson would call the political illusion, which is not a phrase he made up, but it's just that when we think that all problems are political and all solutions are political, and therefore all measures of success are political, it may be that Christian faithfulness and Christian success might be smaller numbers in our churches, but a pruning out in terms of our commitment to truth and to loving our neighbor. And that actually might be an indicator of success. Yeah. You know, and so I think we need to, again, draw our categories out of biblical ones, not just out of cultural ones of power.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's an excellent point, and relying too heavily upon a political solution and then being thrown into despair when that political solution does not pan out, perhaps has led some believers to abandon culture. And of course, the consequences for abandoning culture, well, I think we're seeing some of the results of that today. The church in the 60s and 70s took that approach and opted for political activism over cultural engagement to a large degree. Now, that's, again, a very broad brushstroke of a statement. But when we turn away from culture and abandon it to the consequences of its adopted morality, that is a horrible idea for the church, don't you think?
Well, it is, but, you know, again, we have to stay in politics just like we stay in any place.
Yes.
Because Christ is Lord of all. And the other thing is, I think we forget sometimes as well, is that in the political space, you're dealing with policy. You can't necessarily deal with the level of person-to-person concern that the gospel requires us to. And so I think we have spent so much time yelling at the top of culture, in particular Hollywood and D.C., that we haven't done everything that we can in terms of understanding the power of local culture, what you might call middle America or civil society. And this is the way, actually, cultures are rebuilt, not from the top down, but from the middle out.
Yes.
And because the strong middle institutions, and I mean by that primarily family and churches and so on, you know, these actually catechize individual citizens so that they can govern themselves and that they can, you know, live for bigger things and that they're not caught up into immediate gratification. And that's the power that of localized, you know, work. And I think that's what we have got to, that's what we've got to do, is aim for the middle in terms of our cultural engagement.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Some, some folks say that we should focus on evangelism and getting people into heaven, sharing the gospel and so on and so forth, and not worrying about society. But I like your answer that, no, we need to engage culture and build it from the middle out, not from the top down. In fact, I think that's probably a Twitter quote. That's worthy of a Twitter.
good.
So how do we answer folks then that suggest that Christians should not care about culture? We should just worry about ourselves and take care of our own communities and focus on that. How do we answer those folks?
I think three ways. Number one is even if we do primarily care about evangelism, we have to care about the culture that is shaping the people we are trying to evangelize. So no one would become a missionary to India without getting to know the Indian culture, Hinduism, you know, the religion of the day. And we're in the same situation. We live in a culture that needs to be understood if we're going to reach those people that are impacted by that. But that's not all. I mean, the second thing is we should care about culture, because we're human, and because that humanity was designed by God. The Bible doesn't begin in Genesis 3 that we're sinners in need of a Savior. It begins in Genesis 1 that we're image bearers who sinned and are in need of a Savior. And so we go back then to the result of salvation that we read about in, you know, Romans and John and Peter and their letters, and they use all these rewords as if we're not just being saved from something, but we're being saved back to something, and you might argue saved for something. And, you know, why do we have this vision of humanity in Genesis 1 and 2 that's so robust and so clear about what God wants us to do, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it? It's what many people have called the cultural mandate.
Yes.
If we care about all of God's truth, we have to realize the cultural mandate was never rescinded, and we have to understand the gospel commission, the Great Commission, in light of the first thing that God told us to do is to be human. And look, we can't really live separated from culture, you know? I mean, our churches form cultures.
Yes.
You know, we still buy cars and participate by, you know, listening, watching, you know, listening and watching and selling and buying and so on. And so to think that we can be out of culture really is just to be selective. Yeah. In our what we consider to be culture. Yeah. But then the final thing is, look, if we really are to love our neighbors, we can't just love them. We have to care about the conditions that in which they live. I mean, there came a time for, let's say, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, where to really love his neighbor well, he needed to do more than just say hello to the Jewish guy that everybody else was calling bad names to. He realized at some point he needed to get political. And as Eric Metaxas, my co-host from Breakpoint, said, he said, I bet, you know, there was a whole bunch of Jews in Germany that were really praying that those Christians would get political.
Yes.
And we see some of the great ways, Martin Luther King Jr., for example, and some of the other ways, in some of the monasteries where they brought learning and education in and essentially saved Western civilization because they were concerned about those kind of groundings of culture. Mm-hmm. The art and the education and the business and the structures and the systems, because people we don't live in a vacuum. We live in a society that's shaped by ideas, and those ideas are good ones or bad ones. They either bring us life or they bring us death.
Yes.
So if I love my neighbor as myself, I'm going to have to care about those things too.
That's right. Francis Schaeffer pointed out that philosophers' ideas move from the academy to the population over time. That gives me hope because it means that we have an opportunity to identify those ideas that are being pushed down, and we have an opportunity to address them and counter them with biblical truth. So I very much appreciate your response, John. I wonder, are there any new projects in the works for you? I know you just took on a new responsibility there at the Colson Center.
Well, that's the biggest thing. I mean, I'm excited. After the same-sex marriage book, my friend Warren Smith and I did put out another book, just came out this year, called Restoring All Things, and it kind of takes that vision of cultural engagement and renewal and fleshes it out in 14 or so different cultural areas and tells the stories of Christians who are actually doing remarkable things. I mean, if we think all hope is lost, please pick up this book, because what you'll find is kind of like what I felt at the end of it after compiling all these stories with Warren. that there's a whole lot of other there's a whole lot of the work of God and the work of the Holy Spirit that you and I don't know about, right. And it's happening in everyday neighborhoods and everyday lives. You know, it's kind of like when God told Elijah after Elijah said, "I'm the only one." He said, "No, you're not. You don't even know about these other 7,000 prophets that have not bowed their knee to Baal." And that was really the same thing. You know, it was a remarkable amount of work being done by Christians in these broken areas, and they're answering the problems. Sometimes the problems that the sexual revolution has brought on to us. And so we're really excited about that book project, Restoring All Things, and it's out now from Baker. And at the Colson Center, we're really excited about just expanding our reach and kind of carrying on that wonderful ministry that Chuck Colson started, helping Christians think about the culture from a Christian worldview.
Yes.
And, that involves both informing part of what we do, which is helping on an everyday basis, the breakpoint commentaries and the point commentaries, help Christians think about culture and cultural issues. And then also the equipping. I mean, Chuck started a program of training Christians in Christian worldview, those who wanted to go really deep. With him, a program called the Centurions.
Yes.
Well, we just renamed that program after Chuck. It's now called the Colson Fellows Program. Over 900 mm-hmm. Christians in all walks of life, in all stages, whether, you know, parents, grandparents, young adults, or whatever, to actually go deeper and find out how to apply the Christian worldview in a redemptive, restorative way in their own neighborhoods, in their own arenas of influence. And that's something we're real excited about seeing relaunch here in 2016. And so there's a lot going on, and probably the best place to start is at breakpoint.org.
Nice. Where else can they find you, John? Social media, Twitter? I gave that Twitter handle.
Yeah, Twitter is probably the next best place. I think I'm out of friends on Facebook. It's kind of weird to be out of friends, but find me on Twitter. That's a good place to go.
Yeah. John, I appreciate you being on Soaring Eagle Radio. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's an honor. Thanks so much for having me.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad. You can listen, of course, to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Mica 68 Productions. You can visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, Pastor Mike at woh.rr.com.